Okay. I have to say that the, not the lightning talks, but the panel that was before that was, I believe, the perfect introduction to what I'm going to talk about, because I actually have two things I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about the hash data sets that this creates, and I'm going to talk about how do you know that your forensic tool works correctly, both of which were themes that were brought up earlier. Just give a little background for how NIST is not part of law enforcement. We're just a scientific agency. We do standards and testing for what have you, everything. Law enforcement came to us and said we needed help with a particular problem, computer forensics. So we addressed it from a computer science point of view. So originally it was law enforcement that came and said we want help with these areas. But for quite some time we've always known it's not always going to be for law enforcement. There are going to be other applications for this kind of work. And the first, I've added this slide to you, the first two federal partners we started working with were actually the National Archives and the Election Assistance Commission, because people recognized that they had needs for these kinds of tools that extended beyond the traditional law enforcement boundary. So why is NIST involved in these? This is, we have a mission to assist federal, state, local agencies. We are a neutral organization. Law enforcement, when they said they wanted something they knew worked right, when law enforcement tests themselves, people don't always believe them, except with them, all over the country. And the NIST provides an open, rigorous process for how these things get done. So if I will say we're federal, we're not law enforcement. You know, government agencies also do defense. the government as a whole does both. So some of you may be familiar with NSRL. People seem to generally sort of know what it is. It is actually besides it's the hash sets people use, but it is actually a physical collection of the media we take in. Then there's a big database behind there where we actually image everything in, and we collect metadata about it. And then there's the hashes, and we do the hashes, and then there's what we distribute, the RDS, the hash sets, which just contain the hashes and the subset of the data that describes it. Why do people use the RDS? People use it to do, when law enforcement uses it, they do a lot of the same things you do. Sometimes you want to eliminate your own files from the examination. It's just another piece of software, don't need to be looking at that. Sometimes you want to identify software from a system integrity management point of view, like the virus community all uses the NSRL before they, as a final check before they declare that something is a bad piece of software, and make sure it's not the NSRL and some part of somebody's program, for example, we'll cover up recently. You might want to discover, you have file names with unknown contents. It says it's word.exe, it is not word.exe. And sometimes you want to look for malicious files. The NSRL collects known software. It is not always known good, because sometimes there's not really much of a difference between a system administration tool and a hacking tool. So we collect known, and we leave it to the users to identify whether it is a malicious or benign interest to you. It provides rigorously verified data for use in forensic investigations. The hashes you get from this, you should know are good. And it's used by all the major forensic tools. And people have talked about FDK and NK. They all have little buttons that say import the NSRL. Some of them actually come pre-shipped with the NSRL already in it. So our process is we collect the software. How do we get it? Some of it we just purchase. We get bankrolled by the FBI and by the National Institute of Justice to purchase software. We both buy it on physical media, and this is a recent change that since we've been arguing for many years. We also can purchase it via download, and soon we will also have other mechanisms to get downloaded software. And companies donate it to us also. We don't have enough budget to buy all of Oracle, but the Oracle Corporation is a civic-minded organization. We talk to the right people, and they actually just open up a channel for us to download all of Oracle, which is good. So then we keep it in the library. We also then keep an image of it on Grady, so that we will plan to preserve for as long as that goes, so we'll keep it. And then we put it out as the RDS. It's been growing, that's good. But there's ways to identify software beyond file hashes. File hashes are a wonderful, beautiful thing. They are a really strong way of knowing that whatever it is you hashed stays the same. But because, of course, if you change one tiny little bit, you get a completely different hash. And sometimes that's not actually what you're looking for. Sometimes you want to find things that contain parts of something that are close to something. And there are other techniques people are using, block hashes, where you actually divide the file and you just take the blocks. And another one, so that finds pieces of files, and fuzzy hashes, where you look for similar files. And we actually collect this information within the MS-RL2. It's not published as part of the RDS. If you want block hashes, you have to use the Bloom filter if you want to use them, because it makes a lot of them. But there are also other traces of software that are left out in your Windows registry, in memory. We're also, as researchers develop tools to characterize software, we then can incorporate them into the MS-RL. Remember, we have all copies of all that software on it, on array, so we can just get a new algorithm, let it start running, and collect, you know, collect this new information. We did a project with the National Archives that I mentioned before. They gave us a copy of the redacted files from the first push. It was 2.3 gigabytes, it was 51,000 files, and they said, can the MS-RL, this was a little while ago, can you help us do this? So we identified all these 51,000 files. There were 11,000 of them that were unique. Of those, 8,000 of them were in the MS-RL. They were just software files. And then we used other techniques to look to find pairs of hashes so that they could find, like, you know, people had the same copy of the same memo also. We also did that for them, because the same memo shows up on everyone's drives in the administration. And then we also used some fuzzy hashes to find other pairs of similar files that they could use as a starting point for their researchers. And then we created a disk for them so that they could do all this themselves. So they used it to, so the MS-RL can be used to identify millions of software files and packages, but also any file you find, we can tell you what packages it was ever in. So we can go both directions. So from that, you can develop a pedigree. In fact, within that, once the files we got from the archive, we could actually tell them exactly what upgrade path people had taken on the computers, because we could find the update files. So you could actually see their whole history of how they updated the files, if you cared how the Bush administration updated the files. And so most people use it, of course, to separate and identify software files from user-created files. That is most common use. We also do something else that perhaps you're not familiar with. So people said, wondered, how do I know that my tools work correctly? Well, the law enforcement community worries about that too. They're going to send people to jail based on, sometimes, from the evidence that's what's on their hard drives. They need to be able to present this. They need to really know and be able to prove that their tools work. So they actually came to NIST and asked us, we want you to do a testing program. We said, oh, we'd love to do a testing program for you. You need to have a standard what it's going to do, and we'll develop tests that will tell you if it's done. So there's some benefits to this. One, not every tool works perfectly. In fact, tools, even the best tools, are only best in the environments they're designed for. So if you know how well your tool performs, you know when's the right time to use it. So users can make informed choices, especially when you're looking at cell phone forensics. Cell phones change so fast, none of the tools can stay perfect. Even if they were perfect to begin with, could stay perfect. Reduces challenges to admissibility. And there's another one, you know, it's not just in criminal investigations, but also if you're looking at e-discovery or civil issues. And also their tool creators can create better tools, which of course is the real goal at the end of the day, is that they're quality tools in the hands of the users. So we actually have, we're active in the following areas: disk imaging, which was mentioned many times, hard disk write blocking, which was mentioned a couple of times, a deleted file recovery, which was not mentioned directly, but was implied a couple of times. Forensic disk reuse, probably not as much an issue for you, but when you are done with a case and you want to reuse some of those disks, you've got to make sure that none of the previous case is still on them. String searching, probably another area of interest to you. And mobile devices, which is, we can separate from disk imaging because it's such a different field, which we actually divide in three different areas. So the string searching, we're actually working with the National Archives on this. And we'll have a specification and a test method that will address searching both whether you can find a string in a record or in the space between records, and also to search in multiple languages and character sets, which may not be quite as much an issue for you, but it's a very big issue for the law enforcement.
It's a big issue for us, too.
It's an issue for you, too, yes. Well, I know we're starting out with Chinese, Russian, and probably Arabic, and we'll probably move on from there. Fortunately, the man who runs the CFTT program happens to speak Chinese and Russian, so it's kind of handy. And I think he'd like to learn Arabic. Imaging is an issue you brought up. We have tests that address imaging, hard disks, RAID, CDs. We don't do floppy, sorry. And cell phones, and somebody had somewhat more specific numbers. I just have this, you know, half of the world's population has a cell phone. And when you look at the context and creating some important person's world or future research, or what's going to do that more than their iPhone or their Droid or their personal assistant is really what's going to create. And I wanted to actually put in a plug here, because several of you mentioned DD. Bill's organization makes some tools, and many of them are available to some of the only law enforcement. But they make a version of DD that's actually very nice. So DC3DD, and you can find it on SourceForge. But if you are interested in whether your disk imaging tool works, all of the test reports we have, they're actually all hosted at the National Institute of Justice website, but you can get to them through the NIST website, which has a URL you can actually conceivably follow. So at www.cftt.nist.gov, you can find the function you're interested in, and then a list of all the tools that have been tested, and you can go use them. Now, chances are your version of the tool may be a little different from what we tested, but this can still give you some assurance that what the tool's capabilities are in general. And these are the people who run the various parts of the program. And with that, Leah, coming up.